be tuned out. Laugh it off sometimes. Humor can actually work wonders under certain circumstances, and it's a disciplined strategy that can be used to diffuse countless potentially explosive scenarios. Use it liberally in situations that would otherwise lead you to exasperation. For instance, when baby refuses to allow you to put a snowsuit on. Instead of doing battle over screeches of protest, head off the struggle with some unexpected silliness. Suggest, say, that you put the snowsuit on the dog or on yourself and then pretend to do so. The incongruity of what you're proposing will probably take your baby's mind off of objections long enough for you to get him or her suited up. That sticky face needs a cleanup, but just spying the washcloth is a non-starter. Win baby over with funny songs. This is the way we wash the face, or outlandish play-by-play commentary. Here comes the cleanup monster, as the washcloth swoops down and gobbles the jelly-smeared cheeks, or make goofy faces in the mirror to distract from the dastardly deed. Just make sure you don't laugh when the situation demands a serious approach.
Losing control. Sometimes anger can get the best of even the most loving parent. But if you feel you can't control your anger and that losing control leads to hitting or shaking, if one slap leads to another, if the slap is hard enough to leave a mark on your child or aims for the face, ears, or head, or if you strike out under the influence of alcohol or drugs, you should talk about your feelings and actions with your child's doctor, a family therapist, or another helping professional, or talk to someone at Child Help National Child Abuse Hotline, 1-800-4-A-CHILD. As soon as possible, though you may not have seriously hurt your child yet, the potential for physical or emotional damage is there. Now is the time to get some professional help before an angry outburst leads to something more serious, even if that something serious isn't physical, but verbal abuse. If your spouse shows issues with anger and aggression, or if you feel he or she has the potential to do harm to your baby, physically or emotionally, he or she also needs help from a professional. Call for that help now. Chapter 16, The 11th Month.
You may have a baby Houdini on your hands this month, whose major preoccupations are getting into things he or she shouldn't be getting into, and getting out of things he or she shouldn't be getting out of. There's no shelf too high and no cabinet handle too unwieldy to deter a 10-month-old baby on a mission of seek and, what seems like, destroy. Accomplished as an escape artist, baby may now try to wriggle out of diaper changes, strollers, high chairs, in other words, any confining, read, safe, situation. Along with great physical advances, which may even include first steps for a few babies in the 11th month, come remarkable verbal strides. Not in the number of words spoken, a couple max if any, but in the number of words understood, as many as 20 to 50. Looking at books becomes a much more interesting and enriching experience as baby begins to recognize and possibly even point to familiar pictures. In fact, pointing or gesturing with a few fingers or even the whole hand will soon become a favorite activity no matter what baby's doing. Just one way he or she is able to communicate quite capably without words.
Feeding your baby. Weaning from the bottle.
Ask most pediatricians when a baby should be weaned from the bottle, and the majority will say by the first birthday, and definitely no later than 18 months. Ask most parents when they actually wean their baby off the bottle, and many will say much later than that. There are lots of reasons why parents and little ones hang on to the bottle for longer than doctors and dentists recommend. Reasons ranging from convenience for mom and dad, to comfort for junior, to less mess for everyone involved. Babies who are used to falling asleep with a bottle, or to nipping from one during the night or early in the morning, and parents who are used to buying themselves a good night's sleep or a later wake-up call don't tend to be in a hurry to drop the bottle either. Add in the dreaded withdrawal process. Rare is a tot who gives up the bottle without a fight. Make that many fights. And it's no wonder there are plenty of 2- and 3-year-olds who still haven't kicked the bottle habit. But here's the message about bottles most experts would like parents to pay attention to. Weaning at 12 months or as soon as possible after the first birthday is best for your baby, and there's no shortage of reasons why. First of all, as with many other attachment objects of babyhood, such as a pacifier, being rocked to sleep, and so on, old habits die hard. And the older the habits and the baby are, the harder they are to break. Weaning a fairly flexible 1-year-old is like taking candy from a baby, compared to tussling with a strong-willed 2-year-old over the beloved bottle, especially at nap time and bedtime. Second, when an older baby uses a bottle, he or she runs the risk of developing tooth decay from bottle feeding, and not only because there are now teeth to decay. While an infant is usually fed in a parent's arms and the bottle removed when the feeding ends, a mobile toddler often totes the bottle wherever he or she goes. This drinking on the go and nipping all day long allows the milk or juice to bathe teeth in sugar, with cavities the potential result. So does falling asleep with a bottle, nipping during the night, or falling back to sleep in the early morning hours with a bottle in hand. Another health risk tots over 12 run when they take a bottle to bed, or otherwise drink one lying down, a greater susceptibility to ear infections. Third, toddlers who are bottle drinkers often end up drinking more juice or milk than they should, filling up on too many liquids and taking in too few solids. Not only are these toddlers more likely to become fussy eaters, not surprising since their tummies are always full of juice and milk, but they may miss out on important nutrients. If their bottles are filled with juice, particularly apple juice, they can also wind up with chronic diarrhea. And if you're still not persuaded to switch to a cup in the next month or two, consider these potential developmental drawbacks of continued bottle use. A toddler who's constantly toting and nipping from a bottle has only one hand free for playing and exploring, and a mouth too full to speak out of. If your baby hasn't started on a cup yet, it's time to make the introduction. While introducing the cup is relatively easy at this age, getting your baby to give up the bottle entirely and take all his or her liquid from a cup is a little more challenging. Following these suggestions can make the switch from all bottle to all cup a little smoother. Time it right. While you shouldn't expect your baby to be completely bottle weaned until closer to a year, there's no reason not to start the process now. But be smart about timing. It's best not to start weaning your baby from the bottle if he or she is sick, teething, or otherwise out of sorts. And wait until baby has settled down again after a big move, new childcare, or any other stressful time before pulling the bottle plug. Also hold off on weaning if your little one hasn't yet mastered the cup. Get the cup up and running before you retire the bottle. Otherwise, baby won't have anything to drink from. Go slow. Unless you're planning a cold turkey approach to kicking the bottle habit, a technique probably better suited for an older toddler whose help can actually be enlisted in the plan, the best way to transition from a bottle to a cup is by gradually phasing out the bottles while phasing in the cup. There are a number of ways to do this. Drop one bottle feeding session at a time and replace it with a cup. Allow a few days or a week before replacing the next one with a cup. Middle-of-the-day bottles will be easier to cut out first. The early morning and bedtime ones are usually harder to give up, as well as any bottle baby takes before nap times, especially if it's been used as a fall asleep habit. In other words, it has become a sleep association. Put less formula or milk, formula for babies under a year, whole milk for those over a year, in each bottle than your baby normally takes, and top off each bottle feeding with a cup. slowly decrease the amount of formula or milk in the bottle while you increase the amount of formula or milk in the cup. Swap out the formula or milk in bottles with water, starting with one feeding at a time. Serve that feeding in a cup. Pretty soon your baby may decide that bottles aren't worth it just for water alone. And even if he or she does cling to water bottles, at least no harm will come to baby's teeth. Juice, if it's on the menu at all, should be served up only in a cup. Just make sure as you transition to cup that your little one gets enough total formula or milk, or enough in the way of other calcium foods, say cheese and yogurt. Banish the bottles. Out of sight, out of mind, hopefully. To make the transition a little easier, start stashing the bottles behind closed cabinet doors, where your baby can't see them. When you're ready to call it quits on the bottles altogether, box them up, give them away, or recycle them promptly. At the same time, make sure your baby spies cups around the house often. In the refrigerator, on the kitchen counter, on the dining room table, in the diaper bag. Go cup crazy. Choose cups with features designed to charm your little sipper. Cups with bright colors and cute designs, or see-through cups that allow baby to watch the liquid swish around. Foul-free sippy cups with straws. Cups with handles. Cups without handles. Cups indented in the middle or shaped like an hourglass for easy gripping. Or ones made out of rubber for even easier gripping. Cups with silicone spouts. They feel more nipple-like. Or cups that are vacuum-insulated stainless steel, so the contents stay cool and fresh for hours. Cups that have separate valve parts and those that don't. Cups with molded handles, cups with smooth handles. Cups with lids or open cups with inserts that control the flow of liquid anywhere along the cup's rim. In other words, without a cover and spout. The options are endless, so experiment with a few or a lot to see what your baby likes best. Put the cup in baby's hands. It may take longer for your little one to finish a cup of formula than it did a bottle, but with practice, that should turn around fast. Try to avoid interfering with baby's practice, maneuvering the cup into his or her mouth yourself, for instance, or constantly correcting technique, even if it's messier or less efficient than you'd like. Remember, the bottle was in baby's control, so the cup needs to be too. Expect less. Less milk, that is. Expect your baby to take fewer ounces of formula during the weaning process. Once he or she adjusts to taking all daily liquid from a cup, you'll see the number of ounces tick up again. Keep in mind that older babies approaching their first birthday need fewer total ounces of formula, only 16 to 24 ounces, than younger babies do, making the end of that 12-month mark a perfect time to wean. Teach by example. Babies at this age love imitating adults, particularly adults they love. Take advantage of this urge to mimic and drink from a sippy or straw cup along with your baby. Be positive. Every time your baby uses a cup, serve up positive reinforcement. Clap, praise, make up a cup song to keep up your little one's motivation. Try toasting, too. Show your tot how to clink his or her sippy cup with your cup, along with a chorus of cheers or bottoms up. It will quickly become a beloved ritual for your baby at meal and snack times. On the flip side, avoid criticizing your baby for slow progress with the cup or belittling your little one for clinging to the bottle. That will only make him or her cling more tightly. Be patient. Habits of a year or longer generally don't get kicked overnight. You can expect mission bottle wean to take several weeks, even a month or two, to be completely accomplished. Hang in there and help your baby hang in there too. Be consistent and don't cave. Once you've dropped a bottle from the schedule, keep it dropped. And you'll be rewarded eventually. If it takes more time than you'd anticipated, that's fine, even if you don't end up fully weaning until months after the first birthday deadline, as long as you're gradually making progress. Fill baby up with love. For most babies, the bottle provides not only nourishment, but also comfort. As you limit the amount of time your baby has the bottle, be prepared to fill in the comfort gap with extra hugs, extra play sessions, an extra bedtime story on your lap to help your baby feel secure in the face of change. A new comfort object, a blanket or stuffed animal, can also help ease the transition.
Baby basics at a glance. 11th month. Sleeping. Like last month, your sweet dreamer should be clocking an average of 10 to 12 hours per night and taking two naps during the day, each around an hour and a half to 2 hours long, for an average total of around 14 hours each day. A few babies may start to fight their morning nap this month, probably not in their best interest. If yours does, be sure he or she is getting enough overall sleep. Eating. Your cutie will be taking in less breast milk and formula now that solids are figuring more prominently into his or her diet. As the first year comes to a close, baby will likely breast or bottle feed no more than 3 to 4 times a day, taking about 24 ounces total. More than that in fluids, and baby's appetite for solids may be drowned. Baby's breastfeeding more than 4 times a day? That's fine, as long as there's also room for solids. Baby will probably gobble up around 1/4 to 1/2 cup each of grains, fruit, and veggies every day, or even more if your baby's a big eater. 1/4 to 1/2 cup or more of dairy foods per day, and 1/4 to 1/2 cup or more of protein per day. Don't worry if your baby is eating more or less than that. As long as he or she is gaining weight and is happy and healthy, there's no need to get caught up in measurements. Playing. Blocks, stacking toys, puzzles, pegboards, bead mazes, activity cubes, and other toys that encourage eye-hand coordination are perfect for your 10-month-old. Toys like baby basketball hoops and balls will do double duty in the eye-hand coordination and physical development departments, even if your cutie hasn't quite mastered the slam dunk yet. And speaking of physical development, keep the push toys and riding toys within reach to encourage your little ones get up and go. Role play toys, especially ones that mimic mom's and dad's toys, like a play phone or keys, will be especially fun for your little one this month. So will musical toys, a toy keyboard, a xylophone, drums, tambourines, bells, and rhythm sticks. And don't forget to provide your budding artist with lots of crayons, washable markers, and chunky chalk for scribbling, though make sure they're non-toxic, since they're likely to end up in baby's mouth, not just on paper. What you may be wondering about.
Bowed legs.
My baby just started taking steps, and she seems to be bow-legged.
Bowed until 2, knock-kneed at 4, a typical tot's leg certainly won't give a supermodel a run for her money. But even the legs that grace fashion's top catwalks were likely bowed when they took their first steps. Almost all children are bow-legged. Their knees don't touch when their feet are together during the first 2 years of life. And the bowing becomes easier to notice once they start to stand. Then, as they spend more time walking, they typically become knock-kneed. Their knees meet, but their ankles don't. Not until the preteen to teen years do the knees and ankles align and the legs appear to be shaped standardly straight. In the meantime, enjoy those adorable baby bows while you can. If you have any concerns about your little one's bowing, check with a pediatrician for reassurance. Falls.
I feel like I'm living on the edge since my baby started to take his first steps. He trips over his own feet, bangs his head on table corners, topples off chairs. He's fearless, I'm not.
Being a brand new walker can definitely trip a baby up and slip him up, bump him up, and bruise him up, not to mention walk him into a whole lot of trouble fast. For baby, that means countless close calls and falls. For you, it means frazzled nerves and skipped heartbeats. But steel yourself, because misadventures on 2 feet will not deter your intrepid adventurer. And it's a good thing, too, or he'd never learn to get around on his own, or in fact, learn much of anything at all. Mastering walking and the climbing and running and kicking a ball and throwing and hopping and jumping to come takes plenty of practice, along with lots of ups and downs. At this point, he may be down more than he's up. So don't bother running interference while he perfects his stride. Your role, other than that of proud but nervous spectator, is not to stand in the way, but to do everything possible to ensure that when your baby falls, he falls safely. While taking a tumble on the living room rug can bruise his ego, tumbling down the stairs can bruise a lot more. Bumping into the rounded edge of the sofa may draw some tears, but colliding with the sharp corner of a glass table may draw blood. To decrease the chance of serious injuries, be sure your house is safe for your baby. And even if you remove the most obvious hazards from your baby's path, remember that the most important safety feature in your home is close and constant adult supervision. Remember, too, that how you react to your baby's slip-ups shapes his response. Panic with each fall, and so will he. Worry endlessly about every bump, and he'll believe there's reason to worry. Shrieks of, "Are you okay? Are you okay?" or dramatic gasps and shudders are sure to cue the crying, even if the fall didn't hurt. The idea is to protect him without becoming overprotective, which may make him overcautious. Respond instead with a calm, "Oops, you fell down. You're all right. Up you go." And you'll help your little trooper take minor tumbles in stride, getting right back on his feet without missing a beat. Shoes for walking.
Our baby has just taken her first steps. What kind of shoes does she need now?
The best shoes for a new walker are no shoes at all. Since walking barefoot actually helps build arches and strengthen ankles, those tiny feet will develop best when they're bare, not covered and confined. But barefoot won't always cut it, as when your baby is outside and her feet need protection from broken glass, dog poop, or from being stepped on by other people's shoes. So it's time for a trip to the shoe store to look for shoes that are as close to bare feet as possible. Look for just right fit. Your baby's shoes should fit her just right. Too big and your baby may slip, slide, and even trip in them. Too small and they'll pinch and restrict. Check the width by pinching the side of the shoe at its widest point. If you can grasp a tiny bit of it between your fingers, the width is just right. Check the length by pressing your thumb just beyond the tip of the big toe. If there's a thumb's width, about a half an inch of room, the length is right. Check the heel fit by trying to slide your pinky between baby's heel and the back of the shoe. It should fit, but snugly. Reddened areas on baby's toes or feet when shoes are removed means the fit is too tight. Lightweight. New walkers have a hard enough time putting one bare foot in front of another. The weight of a heavy shoe can make this tricky new skill even more challenging. So think lightweight, soft leather, canvas, or cloth. Flexible non-slip soles. Feet are flexible, and shoes should be too. You should be able to bend the toe of the shoe up about 40 degrees easily. And look for a shoe that has good traction to help keep your baby on her feet. Non-skid leather or rubber soles, especially those equipped with grooves or bumps for when baby becomes a more proficient walker, will keep your baby from slipping as she walks and won't be so ground-gripping that it'll be hard for her to lift her feet. Even dress shoes should have good traction on the soles. Padding. The shoes should offer firm support, but should be padded on the heel backs and around the ankles to minimize rubbing and on the bottom inside for comfort. Secure closures. Whether the shoes are secured with Velcro, snaps, or laces, be sure that they are easy for you to secure onto baby's feet, but not so easy that they can come loose by themselves or be undone by a baby's agile fingers. Slip-on shoes might be easy on, but keep in mind that they're also easy off and can fall off easily too. Reasonable price. Shoes should be built to take it, but they don't have to be built to last forever. After all, your baby will be growing out of them every 3 months or so. Remember, too, that a good shoe is only as good as the sock in it. Socks, like shoes, should fit well and be of a material such as cotton that allows feet to breathe. Make sure they fit without restricting the foot and that they don't bunch up or wrinkle. When socks start leaving marks on the feet, it's time to move up to the next sock size. Not pulling up yet.
Although she's been trying for some time, my baby hasn't yet pulled up to stand. Shouldn't she be able to by now?
For babies, life's a never-ending series of physical challenges. The skills that grown-ups take for granted, rolling over, sitting up, standing, are for them major hurdles to be confronted and conquered. And no sooner is one new skill mastered than another looms ahead. For your baby, next up is pulling up, and it's no small feat on those two little feet. As with all skills, there's a wide range of normal when it comes to pulling up. A few scrappy babies will pull themselves up by 6 months. Others won't pull off pulling up until well after the first birthday, though the majority will fall, make that stand, somewhere in between. The average age for pulling up is 9 months. A baby's weight may have an impact on when she first pulls up. A chunkier baby may have more bulk to take with her than a lighter one does, and so the effort needed may be greater. On the other hand, some lightweights may lack the muscle power needed to pull to a stand, especially if their legs are on the scrawny side. The baby who's cooped up in a stroller, baby carrier, or bouncer much of the day won't be able to practice her pull-ups. True, too, of a baby who has no steady furniture around her to pull up on. Slippery shoes or socks can also slip up pull-up efforts, making a barefoot the best foot to stand on. As is true with almost every developmental milestone, pushing pulling up is only likely to delay it. Babies need to know that their own pace is the right pace, and it is. You can encourage your baby to try to pull up by putting a favorite toy in a place where she has to stand to get to it, and by giving her frequent opportunities to pull up to standing in your lap. She'll build her leg muscles and her confidence. Otherwise, all you need to do is sit back and wait for her to stand in her own good time. Baby tooth injuries.
My son fell and chipped one of his front teeth. Should I take him to the dentist?
Since those cute little pearly whites will fall out someday anyway to make room for permanent teeth, a small chip in a baby tooth is usually nothing to worry about, and pretty common considering the number of tumbles the typical fledgling toddler takes in the course of a day. Still, it's a good idea to make sure you're not dealing with anything that's more than cosmetic. First, do a quick check of the tooth. If there seem to be any sharp edges, give the doctor or dentist a call when you have a chance. The dentist may want to smooth out the edge. If your baby seems to be in any pain, even days later, if the tooth appears to have shifted positions or become infected, swollen gums can tip you off to this, or if you see a pink spot in the center of the chipped tooth, let the doctor or dentist know right away. An injury to the nerve, if left untreated, can damage the permanent tooth that's already forming in your baby's mouth. Either way, try to smile. Chances are there will be plenty more bumps for your baby on the road to walking. Growth swings.
The pediatrician just told me that my son has dropped from the 90th to the 50th percentile in height. She said not to worry, but it seems like such a big drop.
There's much more to a baby's growth than percentages on a chart, and that's why pediatricians look beyond the numbers when assessing a little one's progress. Are both height and weight curves keeping pace fairly closely? Is baby passing developmental mileposts, sitting, pulling up, for example, at about the right time? Is he active and alert? Eating and sleeping normally, for him? Does he appear happy? Does he seem to interact well with his parents? Are his hair and skin healthy looking? It sounds like the doctor is completely satisfied with the way your baby's growth and development are adding up, even with the apparent dip he's taken on the chart. Most of the time, what appears to be a sudden growth shift is just the result of a miscalculation, one made at this last visit or a previous one. Babies are usually measured while they're lying down, and wriggling can easily mess with the results. When a child graduates to upright measurement, he may actually appear to lose an inch or so in height because his bones settle a little when he stands. Plus, getting a toddler to stand up straight and stand still for a precise reading isn't easy. Another common reason for such a growth shift at this time is that a baby who was born on the large side, or who grew quickly at first, is just slowing down as he moves closer to his genetically predestined size. If neither parent is tall, you shouldn't expect your son to stay in the 90th percentile. Chances are that's not nature's plan for him. Height, however, isn't inherited through a single gene, so a child with a 6-foot father and a 5-foot mother may reach adulthood at the same height as one or the other, or taller or shorter than either, but he's more likely to end up somewhere in between. On average, however, each generation is a bit taller than the previous one. Unless you have some reason, other than this drop in height, to believe that something's amiss with your son's growth and development, take your cues from the doctor. If you have a nagging concern, ask for more reassurance. Snacking.
My baby seems to want to eat all the time. How much snacking is good for him?
The snacks are attacking? That's okay. Snacks in moderation play an important supporting role to those three daily squares. Here's why. Snacks are a learning experience. How does baby eat in mealtimes? Often spoon-fed from a bowl. How does he munch away at snack time? By picking up a piece of banana or cracker or a puff with his pudgy fingers and maneuvering it to and into his mouth, all by himself. No small feat, considering how tiny his mouth is and how primitive his coordination. Snacks fill a void. Babies have small stomachs that fill quickly and empty quickly, which means they can't go long stretches between feeds. Enter snacks, which keep that tiny tank filled and blood sugar level, and as solids become the mainstay of your baby's diet, nutritional gaps covered. Snacks give baby a break. Play is a baby's work, and just as adults do, babies need breaks during their workday. A snack provides a breather, a chance to chill with some cheese and crackers before going back on the job. Snacks make for better sleep. Blood sugar can dip during a hopefully long night's sleep, and that can actually prevent a baby from sleeping as long as he should. The right snack, built into the bedtime routine, can help a little one settle down faster and stay settled longer. The right snack before a nap can do the same, while helping your little one wake up feeling more energetic and less cranky. Snacks provide oral gratification. Babies are very orally oriented. Everything they pick up goes right to the mouth, and that's only natural. Snacking gives them a welcome chance to put things in their mouths without having them fished right out by a disapproving parent. Snacks smooth the way for weaning, eventually. Thinking ahead to weaning, whether from a bottle at a year or sometime after that from the breast, getting in the snack habit now will help your little one make that large developmental leap later, with fewer hitches. A bedtime snack can supplement a bedtime feed now and supplant it later. Aim for one snack in the morning, one in the afternoon, and if you think baby needs it, not all do, one before bed. You can build that last snack of the day right into the bedtime routine, as long as it's scheduled before toothbrushing time.
Snacking smarts. Long associated with lumpy couch potatoes and mindlessly consumed calories, and don't even get mom started on how they'll spoil your dinner, snacks have definitely gotten a bad rap, and sometimes for good reason. That is, if there's ever a good reason to plunge headfirst into a jumbo bag of Doritos. But the right snacks at the right time can be smart, especially for your sweetie. Just remember to schedule smart. Mom was right about this. Snacks that come too close to mealtime can interfere with a baby's appetite for meals. Schedule snacks midway between meals to avoid this appetite-sabotaging snafu. Nip non-stop snacking. Snacking that goes on all day, aka grazing, is fine for a little lamb, but not so fine for your little human. Wondering why? Nonstop nibbling can trigger tooth troubles. A mouth that's always full of food is a mouth that's ripe for decay-causing bacteria, which love to feast on sugars. Even healthy snacks like whole wheat crackers or yogurt melts leave behind untender teeth. Weigh your baby down. Certainly your baby won't have a waistline for years to come, and that's a good thing. Rounded tummies are standard issue for tots. But a baby who's always eating doesn't learn appetite regulation. Eat when you're hungry, stop when you're full, eat when you're hungry again. Always having something in his or her mouth now can lead to waistline struggles later. Slow talking. Never try talking with your mouth full. It isn't polite or pretty. Plus, it makes it really hard for others to understand what you have to say. For a baby who's experimenting with new sounds nearly every waking hour of every day, a forever full mouth can limit valuable verbal practice. Cramp a baby's play style. Always having a cracker in hand, like always wielding a sippy cup or a bottle, limits play and exploration, especially if your baby tends to be a two-fisted snacker. Crawling or cruising with a cracker? Definitely not easy. Snack for the right reasons. There are good reasons to snack and not so good reasons. Avoid offering snacks if baby's bored. Distract with a toy instead of puffs. Hurt? Soothe with a hug and a song instead of a sippy cup. Or has accomplished something that's worthy of highlighting. Try a fist pump instead of a fistful of cookies. Snack safely. Snacking should be treated pretty much as seriously as mealtime eating. Snacks should be given while baby is sitting, preferably in the high chair. Why? It's safer. A baby eating lying on his or her back, crawling around, or walking can choke too easily. It teaches table manners, always best learned at the table, and it's easier on you. You'll appreciate not finding crumbs on the sofa and spills on the carpet. Of course, if you're out and baby is in the stroller or car seat at snack time, you can serve it up there. But don't give your munching munchkin the idea that a snack is compensation for serving time in these confining quarters. Being strapped into a stroller or car seat should not be a signal to bring on the crackers and the sippy cup.
Increase separation anxiety.
We've left our baby with a sitter before, and it never seemed to bother her. But now she makes a terrible fuss every time we start walking out the door.
Separation anxiety affects most babies and toddlers, some more than others, and many a lot. Which means that when it comes to being separated from their parents, absence doesn't just make the heart grow fonder, it makes the wails grow louder. Though it may seem like your little one's regressing, after all, your coming and going never bothered her much before, separation anxiety is, in fact, a sign that she's maturing. First, she's becoming more independent, but with strings attached to you. As she ventures off to explore the world on two feet or on her hands and knees, she takes comfort in knowing that you're just a toddle away should she need you. When she separates from you, as when she leaves your side to explore the other side of the playroom or the playground, it's on her own terms. When you separate from her, as when you leave her with a babysitter for a movie and dinner, it's not. You're the one who's leaving. She's the one who's being left. And that opens the door to separation anxiety. Second, she's now able to comprehend the complex, for a baby, concept of object permanence. That when someone or something is invisible, it still exists. When she was younger and you left, she didn't miss you. Out of her sight meant you were off her mind. Now, when you're out of sight, you're still very much on her mind, which means she can miss you. And because she hasn't yet grasped the even more complicated concept of time, she has no idea when or even if you're coming back. Enter more anxiety. Improved memory, another sign of growing maturity, also plays a role. Your baby recalls what it means when you put on your coat and say bye-bye to her. She's now able to anticipate that you will be gone for some indefinite length of time when you walk out the door. A baby who hasn't been left often with a babysitter and seen her parents return often may also wonder whether you'll ever return. Enter still more anxiety. While some babies can show signs of separation anxiety as early as 7 months, it usually peaks between 11 and 18 months for most. But as with everything in child development, the timing of separation anxiety varies from tot to tot. Some little ones never experience it at all, while some start sweating separations much later, around 3 or 4 years of age. For some, it lasts just a few months. For others, it continues for years, sometimes continuously, sometimes on and off. Certain life stresses, such as moving, a new sibling, a new babysitter, or even tension at home, can trigger a first episode of separation anxiety, or a brand new bout of it, or just step it up. Separation anxiety most commonly strikes when you leave your child in someone else's hands. When you're heading off to work, going out for the evening, or dropping your baby off at daycare. But it can also happen at night when you put your baby to bed. No matter what the trigger, the symptoms are the same. She'll cling to you for dear life with superhuman baby strength that makes those arms and sticky fingers particularly difficult to pry off. Cry and scream inconsolably and resist all attempts by anyone to calm her down. In short, she'll try every trick in the baby book to keep you from walking out the door, all of which will leave you feeling guilty and stressed out over leaving her, and maybe even have you thinking twice about leaving again. But as unsettling as it is for you, and as it appears to be for her, separation anxiety is a normal part of your baby's development, as normal, if not quite as inevitable, as learning to walk and talk. Helping her weather separations well now will help her handle them better later on, especially when the separations become ever more challenging, say, being left for the first time at preschool. To minimize baby's anxiety and yours, follow these steps before stepping out. Choose a sitter who can take it. Make sure you're leaving your baby with a babysitter who isn't only qualified, reliable, and experienced, but can also be counted on to respond with patience and understanding, no matter how hysterical your little one becomes once the door closes behind you. Gauge your baby's comfort level with a new sitter by leaving them alone together for just short periods at first, say an hour or so, before staying out longer. Meet and greet before you make your retreat. Have the sitter arrive at least 15 minutes before you're planning to leave, so that she and your little one can get involved in an activity, playing with the shape sorter, stacking blocks, putting Teddy to bed. Keep in mind, however, that your baby may refuse to have anything to do with the sitter, even if she's a familiar one, even if she's grandma herself, while you're still home. After all, consenting to playing with the sitter might mean she's consenting to being left with her. Don't worry, once you're out the door, she'll almost certainly agree to join in the fun. Tame those triggers. As you've probably noticed, even the mellowest baby can melt down in a flash when she's tired or hungry. So try to time separations for when she's recently napped and been fed. Being down with a cold or fussy from teething can also make separations more painful for all involved. Just add an extra dose of comfort before you leave and when you return, and ask the sitter to offer plenty while you're away. Don't sneak out the back, Jack. Sure, it's easier to leave after your baby's sound asleep for the night, or before she's woken from her nap, or just when she's not looking. But that's a strategy that's bound to backfire at some point soon. She'll probably panic when she notices you're gone, or wakes up to find you're not home. And that could result in a whole lot of crying in the short term and trust issues in the long term. You may avoid a scene this time only to have twice the scene next time. Plus, fear that you can leave without warning at any time can increase clinginess even when you're right by her side. Unless you have to leave when she's sleeping, be upfront about stepping out. Take your baby's anxiety seriously, but not too seriously. Separation anxiety is normal and age-appropriate, and to your baby, it's real. So don't laugh it off or ignore it, and definitely don't lose your temper over it. Validate her feelings. Let her know that you understand she's upset. And then reassure her calmly and lovingly that you will come back soon, Just make sure you don't go overboard with the validation, meeting her tears with your tears or matching her anxiety with your own. After all, you don't want to give her the sense that there really is something to worry about when you leave. Let her know when you'll be back. Your baby is by no means a clock watcher yet. The passing of time is meaningless to her. But it's still a good idea to start plugging in concepts of time that she'll eventually be able to relate to. I'll be back after your nap, or I'll be home when you're eating dinner, or I'll see you when you wake up. Start a happy bye-bye tradition. See you later, alligator, in a while, crocodile, is a time-honored phrase that your little one can begin associating with your leaving and returning. Say it with a smile, a quick hug, and a kiss. Other rituals you can add, blowing a kiss, baby will soon be blowing back one of her own, a special wave, or if there's a window, having the sitter hold her there so you can wave from outside. Once you leave, leave. Make the parting short and sweet and final. Repeated appearances at the door, definitely check and double check to make sure you have your wallet and car keys so you don't have to return for them, will make leaving harder for everyone, especially your baby, who won't be able to settle down until she knows you've really left the building. Remember that separation anxiety doesn't last forever, though it may be a year or more before your little one's human cling wrap days are behind her. All too quickly, your child will learn to separate easily and painlessly from you. Possibly for you, a little too easily and painlessly. One day when your teenager heads off to school with a mumbled bye, and if you ask really nicely, a half-hearted hug, you'll look back fondly on the days when you couldn't pry those little fingers and arms off your leg. Bedtime separation anxiety.
Our baby used to fall asleep easily and sleep through the night. But suddenly he's clinging to us and crying when we put him down, and also waking up crying during the night.
Separation anxiety, the familiar gremlin of the daylight hours, can also come out at night. And for some babies, it can produce even more anxiety in the evening. That's not really surprising, given that separating at night, if baby's sleeping in his own crib and in his own room, means being not only left, but left alone, often in the dark. Hello, gremlins. Like daytime separation anxiety, the nighttime variety is normal and age-appropriate. And while it doesn't accompany every baby to bed, at some point it does bed down with most. It also has the same triggers. Your baby's improved memory, his increased independence and mobility, his maturing sense of himself and others. He's wised up considerably since his infant days. And at the same time, his lack of maturity. He's still sorting out the world around him and his place in it. If you co-sleep with your cutie, no separation means no separation anxiety and no problem. That is, unless you expect your baby to fall asleep without you earlier in the evening before joining him later. But if you're determined to keep or make your bed your own, you'll want to find ways to ease the anxiety that sometimes comes out at night and that can prevent everyone from getting the restful evening they need. Here are some strategies for nipping bedtime anxiety in the bud. Have a peaceful prelude to bedtime. Keep the hour or two leading up to bedtime as calm, reassuring, and nurturing as possible, especially if you've been at work all day. But even if you've just been busy around the house, try to give your baby as much attention as you can. Putting everything else, such as making and eating your dinner or catching up on work, on hold until he's asleep. This will help keep his stress level low before bedtime while stirring up some reserves of mommy and daddy comfort he can tap into later when he needs it most. Rely on routines. A bedtime ritual isn't just sleep-inducing, it's comforting at a time in your little one's life when comfort comes from consistency. Each night, it reassures your baby and soon your toddler that the same predictable events will take place in the same predictable sequence. No surprises means fewer anxieties. A bedtime routine can also become the start of a nighttime cycle that your little one will come to anticipate with good feelings instead of fear. Bridge the gap with a lovey. A transitional or comfort object often helps make the tricky transition from awake to sleep easier for your cutie. It could be a favorite small stuffed animal or a tiny blanket for clutching. Big blankets for covering are still not recommended at this age. Not all tots get their comfort fix from a blanket or other type of lovey, but many do. If yours does, bring it on. Think your baby is unsettled by being left alone in the dark? A nightlight can help bring the comfort he needs. Be reassuring. Give your baby a hug and a kiss before you put him down in his crib. Then say your goodnight. Consistency is valuable here too. It's best if you keep the goodnights as routine as the rest of the bedtime ritual. Something like, nighty-night, sleep tight, see you in the morning light. A loving but light tone in your voice will help as well. Just as by day, if your baby senses that you're anxious about separating at bedtime, he will likely be too. If your baby cries, continue to calmly and quietly reassure him, gently putting him back down if he's pulled up. Use this strategy too if your baby wakes up again during the night. Be consistent in your approach to comfort, using the same techniques, the same words, but also try to do progressively less each night. Offering the comfort first from cribside, then from a few feet away, then from the doorway. Saying something like, "Mommy or Daddy is right here. Go back to sleep. I'll see you in the morning." We'll reinforce the message that night will end predictably with day. Or just repeat your chosen goodnight phrase. Be consistent. This deserves repeating and repeating. Without consistency, life is confusing and unnecessarily stressful for little ones. And without consistency, even the best tricks in the parenting book won't work. So even if your new strategy for separations doesn't seem to ease anxiety at first, keep at it. With a consistent approach, your baby will learn to handle nighttime separations and stop fighting bedtime and sleep. Check the guilt at the door. Just as bed sharing is a valid option, so is deciding you'd like to keep sleeping arrangements separate. Once you've made that decision, feel free to feel good about it instead of guilty. Staying with your little one all night won't help him overcome nighttime separation anxiety, any more than avoiding leaving him with a babysitter would help him overcome separation anxiety during waking hours. But a consistent routine, lovingly applied, will. Eventually.
Playing on Team Blue, Team Pink, or Team Neutral? You've stocked your baby's shelves with all kinds of toys, from baby dolls to tractors and everything in between. In other words, the gender-neutral way. So why is it that your little girl always reaches for the baby doll, or your little boy for the tractor? It's unsettling to parents, understandably eager to shatter dated gender stereotypes, but sometimes it seems as plain as the pink or blue beanies babies get matched with in the hospital. Though there's definitely plenty of individual variation from child to child, and lots of overlap too, some little ones seem born to play on either Team Blue or Team Pink. As a whole, boys and girls tend to exhibit developmental differences even in infancy, thanks to the different hormones they're exposed to in utero. Right from birth, girls, on average, show more interest in people and faces than boys do, which may be one reason why little girls are ultimately more likely to play with dolls. On the other hand, boys are born with more muscle mass, which might be why they're, on average, more physically active and may advance physically faster than girls. As they grow, they're also typically better at and tend to gravitate toward activities that take advantage of their mechanical and spatial skills, such as playing with blocks, flipping switches, and pushing buttons. Though boys can be as eager to work their smiles as girls, they tend to be somewhat less focused on faces and more focused on objects. While nature definitely plays a role in how girls and boys play and play differently, nurture is believed to make a considerable contribution as well. Those societal norms have a way of sticking around long after society tries to shed them, even with best intentions and conscious efforts to remain gender neutral in the care of their babies. Parents may inadvertently choose sides based on long passé pink or blue perceptions in nursery color schemes and beyond. Both moms and dads tend to talk to baby girls more than they do baby boys, reinforcing any biological predisposition girls have for focusing on their social development. They may offer comfort more freely to a little girl, nurturing the nurturer in her more than they might in a boy. Boys might get the short end of the comfort stick, but get more in the way of roughhousing fun, which absolutely isn't to say that your little one is locked from birth into gender stereotypes, destined to play actively on Team Blue or socially on Team Pink. Many babies buck gender trends right from the start, and clearly they should be encouraged to color their world any way they'd like, pink, blue, or some unique blend of both. Nor does it mean that you should give up trying to break those outmoded pink and blue molds. Filling your baby's toy box with dolls and trucks, balls and strollers, blocks and crayons is a great place to start, and so is filling your baby boy's need for verbal and emotional attention and your baby girl's need to get physical.
Giving up on a nap.
Suddenly, my son doesn't want to nap in the morning. Is one nap a day enough for him?
Although your little guy's single nap a day may not be enough for you, that's all some babies need as they approach 1 year of age. Most often, it's the morning nap that gets dropped, but occasionally, it's the after-lunch siesta. A very few babies even try to give up both naps at this time. Yikes. Babies of other lucky parents continue to nap twice a day well into the second year. And that's perfectly normal, too, as long as it doesn't seem to be interfering with a good night's sleep. But here's something to keep in mind while you're lamenting the loss of your baby's morning nap. How many times a day your baby sleeps matters less than how well he functions on the sleep he's getting. How well you function on the sleep he's getting is another matter entirely. If nap skipping doesn't bring out the crankies, and if he's not too overtired to settle down for a good afternoon nap and a full night's sleep, then you may have to kiss those two nap days goodbye. If your baby fights his morning nap but is consistently overtired later in the day, it may be that he's resisting the extra rest because it cuts into his busy schedule. Time wasted sleeping, he figures, could be better spent pulling books off the shelf or trying to eat your cell phone. Not clocking in necessary nap time, however, makes for a less happy baby by day, and often one who's too overcharged to settle down at night. To help your baby get the sleep he needs, try a nap time routine that's an abridged version of his bedtime one. Feed and change him, create a relaxing environment. Darken the room and sing a lullaby, for example, and then put him down. Don't give up if he doesn't fall asleep right away, since some babies need more time to settle down during the day. If he still refuses, you can try a sleep training method, but not for as long as you would at night. More than 20 minutes of crying, and there goes his nap time. He's definitely not down for the morning nap, but he's rubbing his eyes long before his usual afternoon nap. Consider having him take that single nap earlier in the afternoon to keep the crankies, his and yours, at bay. If necessary, you can move his bedtime up a bit to accommodate the earlier nap.
For parents, thinking about the next baby. Mother Nature's whims and birth control malfunctions notwithstanding, the decision of how many months or years to wait before getting pregnant again is a couple's alone to make, and different couples feel very differently about the subject. Some feel very strongly that they'd like to cluster their children together. Others feel just as strongly that they'd like several years or more of breathing and sleeping room between deliveries. And the way couples feel about child spacing before they actually become parents, wouldn't it be great to have them just a year apart, isn't necessarily the way they feel once the reality of endless diaper changes and sleepless nights sinks in. Maybe we need a break before we try this again. There aren't very many firm facts to help parents make their decision, Most experts agree that postponing conception for at least 12 to 18 months after baby number one allows a woman's body to recover from pregnancy and childbirth before beginning the reproductive cycle all over again. But that health issue aside, there's little evidence of an ideal spacing period between children. Researchers haven't found that spacing affects intelligence or emotional development or sibling relationships, which have more to do with their personalities than their age difference. The bottom line, it's all your call. The best time for you to add to your family is when you feel your family is ready. Still don't have a clue? Ask yourselves these questions. Will we be able to handle two babies at one time? Children under two, or even three, are high maintenance, requiring constant attention and care. If your second baby arrives before your oldest is two, you'll be doing double diaper duty, enduring endless sleepless nights, and if they're really close in age, dealing with the more difficult aspects of toddler behavior, such as tantrums and negativity, in two toddlers at once. On the flip side, although caring for closely spaced children will probably leave you exhausted at first, once the first few years have passed, you'll have put those challenges behind you, unless you decide to start all over again with number three. Spacing kids more closely together will also mean that you won't have to dig as deep to remember baby care basics, though recommendations can change surprisingly quickly. Another perk for parents? Sibs close in age are likely to enjoy the same toys, movies, activities, and vacations. Do we want to start all over again? Once you're in baby mode, it's sometimes easier to just stay that way, consolidating the years spent on baby care into a shorter, if more intense, time frame. The crib is set up, the diaper wipes are in place, the stroller isn't yet collecting dust in the attic, the safety gates are still up, and you don't remember what sleep or a sex life is, so you won't miss them when they're once again gone. Spacing children far apart requires you to reorient yourself to the demands of having a baby again, just when your oldest is independently off at school and you're getting your lives back in order. Of course, having a new baby a few years after the first allows you ample time to shower attention on one child before the arrival of the next. And since the oldest most likely won't be at home all the time, you'll get that same opportunity to provide individual attention to your younger child. Am I physically ready to go through a new pregnancy? This is a question only a mom can answer. Maybe you just don't feel ready to roll through pregnancy again so soon, especially if your first was a rough ride. Maybe you're not super pumped about the prospect of chasing a one-year-old while you're headed to the bathroom with morning sickness. Or toting a toddler along when you have a watermelon-sized belly. Talk about heavy lifting. Maybe you'd just like a baby-free body break before resuming reproduction and breastfeeding. On the other hand, if you've had nothing but joy producing and nursing your first bundle of joy, maybe you don't feel there's any reason to postpone additional bundles of joy. Or maybe the sound of a ticking biological clock, or the feeling that you'd like to finish up your baby-making days by the time you're a certain age, has you resolute about resuming reproduction sooner than later. What gap will make the kids closer? There's certainly no consensus on this issue, and results can vary widely, depending on the children's temperament, the way sibling conflicts are resolved, the atmosphere around the home, and many more factors. For instance, if there's a very large gap in ages between siblings, they might grow up not feeling like siblings at all, or they might have a very special affection for each other. Siblings spaced far apart may experience less rivalry than those closer in age, since the oldest sibling already has a life outside the home, school, sports, friends, may actually appreciate the new addition more, and may even help out with the baby. Plus, when sibs aren't playing on a level developmental field, there's no need to compete. Or, an older sib may resent the responsibilities of having a baby around the house, or the social life adjustments. Though your little ones won't necessarily be close if they're close in age, their developmental similarities are more likely to make them natural playmates for each other. Of course, it's those similarities that will also make them more prone to sibling squabbles. The fact that they'll probably enjoy the same toys might be both a convenience, fewer toys to buy, and a hassle, more tug-of-war over the toys. Having children close in age may minimize the adjustment of a very young older child to a new sibling. After all, there's less to miss about being the only child if you've been one for only a short time. On the other hand, a very young older sibling may resent the sudden shortage of much-needed lap space. What about us? Also factor in your twosome when contemplating when to expand your family of three to a family of four or more. Clearly, you'll want to make this decision as a united team, considering work and childcare, time together as a couple, romance, and yes, your sex life. How close in age are my siblings to me? If you had a great experience growing up with a much younger or much older sibling, you might hope the same for your children. If you found yourself always fighting with your close-in-age sister or feeling distant from your already grown brother, you may choose to space your own kids farther apart. Thinking about expanding the family again? There are plenty of preconception steps you and your spouse can take to improve your chances of fertility success, as well as the odds of having a safe pregnancy and a healthy baby. For more, check out What to Expect Before You're Expecting. Content with your one and not looking for more in the near future or even ever? One and happily done can be the perfect decision too.
Forgetting a skill.
Last month, my daughter was waving bye-bye all the time, but now she seems to have forgotten how. I thought she was supposed to move forward developmentally, not backward.
She is moving forward developmentally. It's probably just forward to other skills. It's very common for a baby to practice perfecting a skill almost continuously for a while, to her delight and everyone else's, and then, once she's mastered it, to put it aside while she takes on a new developmental challenge. There's also the possibility that she's getting tired of taking bye-bye requests. Your baby is way cuter than any monkey, but she may be feeling like a performing chimp if you're forever asking for repeat performances. Though your baby is tired of her old trick of waving bye-bye, she's more than likely excited by a new one she's rehearsing now. Perhaps barking every time she sees a four-legged animal, or playing peekaboo and pat-a-cake. All of which she will eventually, temporarily retire to once they become ho-hum. Instead of worrying about what your baby seems to have forgotten or prodding her to pull an old trick out again, tune into and encourage her in whatever new skills she's busy developing. You need to be concerned only if your baby suddenly seems unable to do many of the things she did before and if she doesn't seem to be learning anything new. If that's the case, check with the doctor.
All about baby talk for the older baby.
You've come a long way, baby, since you breathed in your first gulp of air and let out your first cry, heralding your own arrival. Look out, world, here I come. From a newborn whose only form of communication was crying and who understood nothing but his or her own primal needs, to a smiling, cooing 3-month-old, to a 6-month-old who started finding a voice and collecting a repertoire of sounds from babbles to bubbles, making sense out of words and expressing a wide range of emotions, to an 8-month-old who began conveying meaningful messages through primitive sounds and gestures, and now to a 10-month-old who has spoken or will soon speak those first real words. And yet, with all the communication accomplishments already behind your baby, still more astounding verbal achievements are just around the bend. In the months to come, your little one's comprehension will increase at a remarkable rate. And though it will lag at first behind receptive language, words understood, your baby's expressive vocabulary, words spoken, will expand exponentially in the next year. Here's how you can help your baby's language development. Label, label, label. Everything in your baby's world has a name. And there's no better way to teach those names than by saying them, often. Label objects around the house. Bathtub, sink, stove, crib, lights, chair, couch. And food that you and baby eat or that you're dropping into the shopping cart at the store. Play eyes, nose, mouth. take baby's hand and touch your eyes, your nose, and your mouth, kissing that sweet hand at the last stop. Point out arms, legs, hands, and feet, as well as shirt, pants, skirt, shoes, boots, coat. Identify birds, dogs, trees, leaves, flowers, cars, trucks, and fire engines wherever you see them. Don't leave out people. Point out mommies, daddies, babies, women, men, girls, boys. And don't forget about baby's name, too. Using it often will help your little one develop a sense of self. Wait a second, that's me. Listen, listen, listen. While keeping up a steady stream of speech helps your baby beef up his or her vocabulary, everyone needs a chance to express themselves, especially baby talkers. When your baby starts jabbering on about what you're not sure, pause, look him or her in the face, and really listen as if you understood every attempt at words. Even if you haven't identified any real words yet, listen to the babble and respond the best you can. Really? That's awesome! Baby's not buying it. The communication gap is so massive that you can't figure out what baby's trying to say or asking for, and frustration's building fast. Point to possible candidates. Do you want the ball? The bottle? The puzzle? Giving baby a moment to let you know whether you've guessed right.